Blog Talk Radio.
That's a theme for the Doc Talk podcast, hosted by a brother, a mentor, and a friend in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Dr. Greg Roscoe. Yours truly, Mark Mancini, producing it in Los Angeles, 347-205-9631. I see you're all alive now, 100 of you, so we'll get to you momentarily. If you missed this show, tell all your friends. It's archived on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered now by Mancini Media. So more of him, less of me. Let me lay the red carpet down, put the podium in its place, hand off the mic to threes. Doc, how are you? How can people get a hold of you? And you're bringing the band of brothers in on this show today.
We sure are, Mark. And, again, thank you for your production skills, Mark. Things are good. The weather's changing here in Pittsburgh. Of course, it's getting cold, getting a little snowy, but boy, it's still beautiful, as always. To get a hold of me, as you always have, gjrmd308@outlook.com. Today's topic is very interesting. We've got some experts on our panel today as well. The topic has to do with concussion. All right, and we've heard, you know, with regard to the NFL, percussion protocols. All right, so we know that people talk about it. They're looking at it. Very, very important. I personally do not treat any NFL players. However, you know, I see these things frequently. And, you know, where I see it in my practice, I have young men playing basketball. I have young men playing football. I have elderly falling and having nasal facial fractures, which indeed lead to concussions. And what I did, I do have two personal friends, but they're also experts. I'd like to introduce my first guest as Mark Varicella, Matthew Varicella. He is an orthopedic surgeon. He deals with sports injuries. I also have his brother, Christopher Varicella. And Chris is a conservator, if you will. He's not a surgeon, but indeed he does deal with sports medicine injuries. So that's kind of how we'll go with the show. You know, our research team had been looking at concussions. And what I'd like to start the program with is, Matt, how about telling me, what do you think a concussion is? How do you define concussions? You know, what when people say to you, do I have a concussion? What are they talking about?
Well, first off, Greg and Mark, thanks for having me on the show. It's always a, you know, pleasure. And
thank
obviously
you.
You're a friend of mine, and we've had some very thoughtful discussions. So this is a great way to open this. The basic definition of a concussion is essentially a mild traumatic brain injury that's characterized by a subsequent or following impairment in the brain's ability to function. Now, this can occur and most commonly occurs from a direct blow to the head, but the important thing to note is that it can also occur from a force elsewhere in the body and that force actually gets transmitted through the head and neck region with the associated injury to the brain.
And Mark or Matt, what kind of injury would that be? What would be an example of that?
So an example, you know, a common one that we see.
As far as looking at this and people experiencing concussions, you know, looking at our research, we do have a research team up here, and, you know, they talk about boxing injuries, martial art injuries, American football injuries, basketball injuries, these contact sports leading to these kind of problems. Does that make sense to you as well? Are you still there? Hello?
Hey, Greg, I can jump in. It's Chris.
Chris, go
without
ahead.
The introduction, I don't know what happened to Matt, but it's Chris. So,
yeah.
So, Greg, that does make sense. There's you touched on a point that was really, it was poignant at the beginning. This is not limited to sports. You mentioned
right.
You had basketball players or you have elderly patients. You know, concussion does not pick and choose, you know, okay, this is a basketball player, you can have a concussion. But, you know, my 65-year-old, you know, mother or, you know, my 80-year-old grandmother, you know, they're precluded from having concussions. That's not how it works. It can affect anybody. But by and large, what you see is either direct force or indirect force to the head. So indirect force, things like a whiplash injury. Some patients
right.
come and I evaluate them, and they didn't have a direct blow to the head. They had maybe a car accident, or maybe they were tackled very forcefully. Their head did not hit the turf or the grass in football, American football, and they're wondering why they have these cognitive symptoms, this neck pain, these headaches, and it can be a result of a direct blow to the head, but also indirectly. And the reason that is because our brain is not tethered inside our skull. It's not battered down in the skull. There's some movement that happens there. And from a whiplash-style injury, you can imagine the brain inside the skull can hit
sure.
the edges of the skull, and that creates an injury to the brain. And it's classified, you know, in technical terms as
yeah.
a mild traumatic brain injury.
Greg, do you mind if I interject there? Sorry, I got kicked off.
Go ahead, please.
I think that's a really important distinction that my brother brought that up about the cervical whiplash injury, and I have an article out there talking about this. There's a distinction there. The whiplash injury can come with an associated concussion or a mild traumatic brain injury, but you can also have a whiplash-associated injury that does not have a concomitant concussion with it as well.
Sure.
There are two separate entities. And what my brother was essentially talking about there, too, is that movement of the brain, that acts, what we'll describe it as is the axonal shear force. They've looked at these brain injury models where that movement stretches the axons. And if they reach an increase in 15% of their resting length, that then associates with a cascade that then ensues of an imbalance in the neurotransmitter release, which causes those ensuing neurologic deficits.
Beautiful.
So there's
excellent.
Let me interject again, Greg, here. There's a
sure,
there's one thing that one thing to keep in mind is we're using a lot of words and terms and things like
correct.
That. One of the biggest things is as a patient, an athlete, otherwise, you know, somebody that's not an athlete that has a head injury or suspected head injury, you need to see a professional to really guide you in the recovery process. And so there's a lot of confusing terms that get thrown out, and you bring up neck injury in along with concussions.
Surely.
A trained professional can sift that out and make the diagnosis for you as well.
Beautiful. And Christopher, we're going to get to treatments, evaluations, you know, a little later in the process. But, you know, what I like to do for my listeners, I like to go ahead and talk about basics. You know, what's the basic anatomy here? And I think Matthew had started with it, you know, that the brain sits in a closed chamber, and it is suspended with fluid and ligaments. And again, the next element of anatomy that's important, if I can just digress here, is C1 and C2, the atlas and then the axis. That's another area where one can have damage. And then, of course, the remaining cervical spine. Do you see that being the case also, Matt? That, you know, these
yes,
are the
absolutely.
Areas sometimes that will sustain it. Whiplash, of course, being one. Direct trauma being one, et cetera.
Yes, absolutely. So when a patient presents with a pure whiplash injury, it actually implies that there's potentially damage to those ligaments around those structures that you just mentioned. Also damage to, there's something called the facet joints in the cervical spine. If those stretch, also the cervical paraspinal muscles, meaning the muscles that are to the side of the bony anatomy. So we don't have to get into too much detail with that, but basically the take-home point that we see, especially as it applies to concussions and traumatic brain injuries, is in these mechanisms, patients that have either compromised structural integrity or say weak functional anatomy or muscular deficit. They're predisposed to these types of injuries. Interestingly enough, they've looked at sex-related differences. So males versus females,
yes.
What causes a female to be more predisposed to having a concussion? Because based on the literature, it's almost two times the increased risk there. And they have looked
that.
At that cervical, yeah, exactly, me too. The cervical paraspinal musculature is not the same as that of a male. So that leads to that predisposition. When you talk about males, the concussion-related mechanism, it tends to be more player-to-player contact, so head-to-head blow or an elbow to the brain, especially in soccer, or to the head, and especially in soccer. It tends to be more equipment-related. It could be, in a soccer scenario, the ball ends
sure.
up getting kicked and it goes off their head. And that, I think, gets back to the point that
yeah.
their muscular control is different than that of males.
No, it's a very good point that you bring up. And what we're saying here, audience, is that between males and females, there's a little difference in symptomology for a specific injury. And, males, of course, tend to get more injury than females because they play more contact sports. But the one very interesting point that you brought up is that in soccer, basketball, lacrosse, that females have almost a 2 to 3 times higher incident rate for concussion. And the literature tells us that overall, because if you're right, the relative strength of the neck muscles, different
yes.
hormonal differences, and of course, style of playing. Just interesting
yes.
that you brought that up. I am going along with all this, just so our audience knows, how popular is this symptom? And, with regard to a study that would – go ahead. I have some data.
Well, I was just going to – the most common you're talking about presentation of a concussion, essentially 70% of the time they're going to present with a headache. That tends to be the
sure.
most common situation.
Yep.
There's something called a myofascial tension headache, where there's pain localized to kind of the posterior neck or the base of the skull region. They may have a post-traumatic headache, which is usually localized to the forehead or the top of the head. That
yep.
tends to be the most common. It's interesting that you bring that up about how common are concussions, because it's estimated to be about 2 to 4 million concussions are occurring on an annual basis. Over 100,000 of these are high school-aged athletes. 1 to 2 million are estimated to be in the population that's 0 to 18 years of age. So that's kind of interesting. Now, what gets
yes.
into a little bit of the nuances here is over the last decade, we've had certainly an increased awareness in the concussions and the diagnosis. So that could be sort of a false elevation if you're following me with that. But I do think that the most concerning
sure.
part of this is the increased incidence that we're seeing in the youth athletes.
Very good. Again, if I can just talk about that as well. With regard to incidents, I have some current data. Your numbers are pretty accurate that, overall with regard to high school athletes, and let's say the grouping 0 to 18 years old, there have been about 4 to 500,000 diagnosed cases of concussion in our emergency rooms in this country. So there's a hell of a lot of that going on in that age group. And, you know, I just got a question here, kind of interesting. And they, the listener asked me, can you get a concussion from a hit in the chin or the jaw? Christopher, what do you think about that?
Absolutely, you can. And you could get hit in the chin and the jaw, and you could not have a concussion. So it's very important to pay attention to the immediacy afterward, the injury, and then later that evening and the next day. Some people really, as patients, and I see a lot of concussions, patients and parents of younger athletes, there was a thought process where, you know, a hit in a game or sporting event happens. Symptoms do not develop right away occasionally. And then the next day they start to develop headaches and things like that. So there's a thought process of, well, it wasn't directly related to the hit. It didn't happen right with the hit, so it's not a concussion. So there's a lot of education that has to happen there. What happens when you get hit to the head, neck area, or a whiplash-style injury is there's actually a lot. I explained to patients, like, there's the 4th of July happens in your brain. So what I mean by that is there's, like, fireworks going off. Everything, you know, the neurotransmitters get released, the things that send the signals between the brain cells. That gets released in excess. And then what happens is light becomes brighter, noise becomes louder, your mood gets irritated. You can have somatic symptoms, like we mentioned, the headache. You could have nausea, dizziness, fatigue, that light sensitivity and sound sensitivity. You could feel slowed down. You could feel like it's harder to process information. It's harder to concentrate on things. You could be sad or more nervous or more emotional than you typically are. You could also have balance problems. There's a lot of, you probably see this, Greg, sometimes with the head injuries that you see. There's concomitant balance problems that happen. You can have loss of consciousness. There's a whole plethora and a range of symptoms. But yes, a hit to the head and the neck with a associated headache should be evaluated for the presence or absence of a concussion, because it might be something that's, you know, still serious, but not as serious as a concussion. You know, maybe a little whiplash style injury, but not concussive symptoms. Or it could be whiplash style injury with the mild traumatic brain injury going hand in hand. And those things need to be sifted out and evaluated by someone that knows what they're doing. But absolutely, any hit to the head and neck with coinciding symptoms, and even if it's not directly with the hit or directly with the play, it's later in the evening, it's the next day, that should still be taken seriously and evaluated for the presence of absence of that mild traumatic brain injury.
No, very nice. Just, I'd like to go ahead.
Go ahead, Matt. Sorry, I keep interjecting on you. But my brother talked on an interesting point there, and I think that something that we're starting to figure out more and more in the literature is what is increasing the susceptibility from individual to individual. So, in other words, a blow that I sustain on my head may not cause a concussion. It may cause that on my brother. So everybody has a different profile in terms of their stress response. So it may be the same blow that from body to body, it's a very different process that ensues. There's genetics at play here too. And I think the other point that we'll probably end up touching on here soon is that one of the biggest risk factors for sustaining a concussion is having a previous concussion, almost 2 to 10-fold. Increasing that risk. So that's something else that should heighten everybody's awareness in that scenario. Exactly.
Yeah, I'll touch on that as well. You know, I wanted to just summarizing what we've done so far, because this is going very quickly. You know, with regard to the concussion and the mode of injury, usually, just summarizing it briefly, you know, it's stretching, it's bruising of the nerves, the blood vessels in the brain, also chemical change in the brain, altering normal brain function. And that's basically what's happening when we do sustain an injury. And I think the other summary important here is that a single concussion may not cause any permanent damage. However, multiple concussions can absolutely lead to permanent structural damage in our brains. Does that make sense also, Mark and Chris?
Yes, that's a great point. It's a tough conversation to have with an athlete, but you know, the biggest thing that happens is, you know, one concussion can sometimes predispose somebody to a second and maybe a third. And then we have the tough discussions often about stacking, or I call them, you know, call it collecting concussions. You don't want to be a concussion collector. You don't want to collect them, because the more concussions you have, the higher the risk of long-term damage, memory problems, issues later in life could possibly occur. You're absolutely right, Greg.
Thank you, Chris. You know, we can expand on all that with predisposing factors, but I've got Mark Mancini in the studio in L.A. Mark, what do you have down there for us?
Well, we've got a load of them, Doc. Frank from Germantown, PA, comes in and says, how does this affect the NFL going forward? I've heard, you know, we've talked about that maybe it'll go to a flag football thing on some previous shows people have been talking about, because the helmets aren't protective enough and the CT scans and all that. What is the future of the NFL? And this is a regular listener. He says, keep up the good work, Doc.
Well, thank you. And let me just start, but I'll, of course, turn it over to our experts. You know, the NFL has a head, neck, and spine committee that evaluates all this, the frequency of concussion, the amount of damage, and then they strategize. And one thing that they've done in the NFL, what I thought was kind of neat, is they have partnered with physician doctors all over the world looking at concussion protocols. And this is not just a problem in our place in the world. It's all over the world. And indeed, it's something that is being looked at on a regular basis. And they do have meetings of these healthcare professionals, neurosurgeons, orthopedics, sports medicine, seeing how they can educate players, improve safety, and help these young men so they don't have permanent damage. But, Chris, do you want to pick that up a little bit too?
Yeah, I can add to that.
Now, you're dealing with professional athletes.
Yeah, that's very accurate, Greg, what you said. It's not one person making a decision. It's the consensus. It's a group. It's ongoing research. It's a hotbed in research. And so NFL is a great entertainment, you know, industry and organization.
Yeah.
But they have player safety as evidence, what Greg just mentioned. You know, they have committees and they have the research and they have the meetings. It's a very hot topic in terms of player health, long-term player health, and it's an evolving topic. There's more research and there's more data that comes out by the week and by the month. And what we're really trying to do is sift through that and what's the important data, what makes sense, what leads to a clinical change in what we're doing. And so I think in terms of the question of how does this leave the NFL, I think the NFL is obviously looking into player safety and head injuries, and that's at the forefront of what they're doing, it seems. And so I think it'll continue to do that, and you'll see more and more research and more changes and more things come down the pipeline because it is such an important topic.
Thank you. Matthew, what's your take on it?
Well, one other point I would say, just to first touch on the flag football element of it, I think the NFL – there are too many competing interests that the pendulum would ever swing that far in that direction, although it's an interesting point, and obviously, like many things in life, the truth lies in the middle somewhere. I think one of the most influential advancements that may come is that Guardian cap that I'm sure, you know, if you've been following the you know, press releases over, at least starting this last summer, the Guardian cap, that soft outer shell that goes over the traditional NFL helmet, and based on the studies, the impact studies, they've shown a 10% reduction in the severity of impact and force magnitude when one of the individuals is wearing that helmet, but also a 20% reduction when both players that come in contact collide. Another interesting point with that, yeah, exactly. So that's obviously the high level. That's the elite of the elite. So we're talking about a very high force of impact there. When you look at that cap and the impact it has on the lower levels, for example, the high school athletes, you're seeing almost a third of the reduction in that force magnitude. So I think, as opposed to moving to something like a flag football situation, it would be more protective equipment modifications.
Excellent. You know, just reiterating a little bit about the NFL, with regard to the people that sit, that they have on these committees, they've involved athletic trainers, even the booth ATC spotters, team physicians, the NFL game officials, coaches, teammates. Also, they have unaffiliated neurotrauma consultants that also work with these committees and these players to try to improve patient safety. So I think we took care of that question. No flag football in the near future. Mark Mancini, what do you have?
Carl and New Rochelle basically stepping in saying, yeah, just to piggyback on that other question, you can see where heavyweight boxing has gone. That's kind of gone off a cliff as far as the fact there's no protective gear when those guys were fighting. There should have been protective gear, and now you're starting to see people like Oscar De La Hoya having problems and stuff even after being out of the ring for quite a while. Wow, great questions coming across the board, Doc.
Yes, go ahead. I have one also that just came through for me. What's the difference between a concussion and a traumatic brain injury? Matt, you want to touch on that?
Yeah, so that, that's a great point. There is overlap. They are. So by definition, a concussion is a mild traumatic brain injury. So the spectrum of brain injury it varies across, like I was saying, the spectrum. So it could be mild or it could be obviously be severe with loss of consciousness, coma, et cetera. The point to kind of focus in on is that mechanism of injury, when the brain undergoes that, it's called an acceleration-deceleration moment, meaning the head kind of whips forward in one direction, then it'll kind of kick back. Coup, contra-coup is another way to describe that.
Sure, those are the words.
But what happened, yeah, exactly. So that they're essentially the same concept there. They're describing the same incident that's happening in the brain.
So we're right. So that was a very good. So there's no misunderstanding of the words. And do you know another question that I've gotten? And Mark, I'm getting beat up with questions up here.
Yeah.
Do you have to be knocked out to have a concussion?
Well, that's a really good one.
Yeah, I'll take that one. That's a great question. You know, as soon as 10, 15 years ago, that was kind of the accepted definition sometimes. Well, I didn't lose consciousness. I didn't get knocked out, so I didn't have a concussion. And that's absolutely incorrect. You can have loss of consciousness with a concussion, with a head injury, and you can also have just a head injury without loss of consciousness, without being knocked out, and still develop concussive symptoms. So really, as we touched on earlier, any blow to the head and neck area or any acceleration, deceleration force, such as a whiplash, motor vehicle accident, can result in concussive type symptoms. It's an excellent point. It's an excellent question. You do not have to lose consciousness. You do not have to be knocked out to have a concussion.
Wonderful.
I'll take that one step further. The loss of consciousness actually only occurs in about 10% of cases. So that's an important point to drive home there.
Yeah.
So anecdotally, what happens on the sideline, I cover a lot of football games, and, you know, sometimes players do lose consciousness. And that does not always equal a concussion. Just because you got knocked out doesn't mean you will end up having concussive symptoms as well. So the inverse is also, you know, holds true. You know, just needs to be evaluated. You can have loss of consciousness and not have a concussion or not have very significant concussive symptoms.
Yeah.
And then sometimes some of the worst concussions I've seen did not have loss of consciousness.
Wow. Interesting, all these facts. You know, I think one of the points that Matthew had brought up was with regard to risk, and that's the previous concussion. If we have an athlete, a player, anyone that's had a previous concussion, they seem to go ahead and have a greater risk of having subsequent concussions. Do you want to expand on that at all, Matt?
Well, absolutely. I think that gets to the point of what happens to the brain after this injury kind of ensues, that neurometabolic cascade, just to use a fancy term with that. Basically, the neurotransmitters, the chemicals that are released by the axons and by the neurons and glial cells whenever the injury occurs, that imbalance leads to a period of susceptibility and vulnerability to have something called a second hit phenomenon, or that period where the brain is very vulnerable to even a minor force magnitude occurring, and the patient or athlete can get a second concussion on top of that. The symptoms that manifest after an individual sustains a concussion, a lot of times that fatigue, that slowed mental processing, that feeling like you're in a fog, a lot of that occurs because the body is trying to correct that imbalance. So all of that energy is going to the mental side, trying to get the brain back to its baseline state. And so that is why the individual feel that way. But I think the driving point there is that period prior is a period of significant susceptibility to have another injury.
Got it. And Mr. Mancini, do you have some more questions for us?
Yeah, let me throw two more, then I'll get it back to you guys. Steve from Corvallis, Oregon, a regular listener, basically says, describe concussions, headaches, and migraines. Do they all kind of work the same if you get these things consistently? Wow.
Yeah, I can take that one. That's a tough – this is Chris. That's a tough question, but a very poignant and good question. So what I mean by that is there's differentiating factors between concussion, headaches, migraine, headaches. I forget the third headache that he mentioned. What was the third headache he mentioned?
Migraines, headaches, and concussions.
Okay, migraines are just general headaches. So the differentiating factor, my brother just touched on this. It's a energy imbalance that happens during concussion recovery. So I'll unpack that a little bit. So what that means is your body is trying as hard as it can, using all its resources, to heal your brain from this mild traumatic brain injury. What that leaves is the rest of your body's functioning and system at a energy deficit, because you're spending all your glucose, all your energy molecules, all your cells going to the brain to try to heal. What that leaves you is even small exertional activities tend to exacerbate or make your symptoms worse. So very classic of a concussion is when you're exerting yourself, you're going for a walk, you're going to work out, you're going to exercise, your symptoms become worse, and it's because of that energy imbalance that was already touched on. The other thing that people don't realize is you can exert yourself from a cognitive standpoint, from a mental capacity standpoint, from trying to process information. So what that means is watching TV, blue lit screens, trying to process information, reading, trying to do simple math, or balancing a checkbook, or trying to figure out where to drive. Those are cognitively exerting activities, meaning you're using your brain's capacity to do those functions. That is something where if you're increasing your cognitive stress doing one of those tasks, or you're increasing your physical stress with a concussion, when you're in the recovery period, your symptoms get worse. That's pretty much, it's distinctly different from something like a migraine headache. So a migraine headache, people that have migraines know there's usually some sort of sequelae, something that leads to their migraine coming on. They can feel it coming on. They see floaters. They see flashes. They can come on in times of stress, but it's not necessarily, predictably with physical exertion or mental exertion. So there's a distinction between the two, but the hallmark of concussive symptoms and concussive headaches are exacerbation or worsening of those symptoms during a mentally strenuous activity or a physically strenuous activity. And it doesn't have to be like running a marathon. It could be something just like taking a walk around the block.
Excellent. I have two little questions here. One is, Chris, you talked about recovery period. In general, the recovery period is what, 2 to 3 weeks for a concussion? Is that kind of a standard, or are we looking at a different form dependent on the severity of the injury? What is the recovery period for a concussion?
That's a great question. So roughly about 8 out of 10 concussions will recover in approximately 14 days, 10 to 14 days. 80% of concussions will recover in that time frame. As Matt already touched on, it's very important during that time frame not to suffer another head injury and things like that. But overall, we see about 80% of those concussions get better in a couple weeks. There are that 20%, that one out of five, that will prolong beyond that 2 weeks. And that's really where there's a lot of treatment modalities and approaches. In central Pennsylvania, central western Pennsylvania where we are, we have a multidisciplinary approach. We use physical therapists. We use ocular therapists. We use neuropsychologists. We use physicians. We have a multidisciplinary team that works
on
treating
ENT?
These concussions. We have ENT that works on our balance problems, like the physicians, the physical therapists, the athletic trainers, the rehab specialists, all working together to get people better, because there are different factors that lead that one out of five to prolong beyond the 2 weeks. So,
beautiful.
Yes, there's a predictable recovery, but then outside of that predictable recovery, there's fortunately a lot of things we can prescribe or recommend to patients to get better beyond that.
Beautiful. Thank you for an excellent answer to that question. You know, just going forward, we still have a little time here. What I'd like to do, I don't mean to digress, but, you know, what are the symptoms of a concussion? You know, what are the most common symptoms? I've got my research where we talk about headaches, nausea, vomiting, confusion, temporary loss of consciousness, balance or gait problems, double vision, ringing in the ears, light sensitivity, feeling tired, drowsy, changes in sleep patterns, either sleeping more or can't sleep, trouble understanding, which is cognitive, depression, being irritable, nervous, anxious, feelings of being just not right or foggy, again, difficult paying attention, forgetfulness, memory loss. Matthew, do you want to pick up on that a little bit? Kind of maybe boil it down.
The points I would just say, you hit on essentially all of the symptoms. You kind of stole the thunder there, which is fine. But I would just highlight that 70%. So most commonly, it's going to be a headache, although it doesn't have to be. And then, as we touched on the loss of consciousness, that's actually lower on the list, but maybe 5 to 10% of cases. The other point that I will drive home is that it's the change in the amount of sleep from the normal habit. So it could be more or it could be less. It doesn't have to be one or the other, but it's just a shift from the baseline. And again, getting back to that point that the reason the body is feeling this way, the reason that an individual who is going through that concussion period, it's because the body's energy is going to correct that balance from the brain injury. So a lot of that, a lot of the energy is going towards that. And that's why it manifests.
So we use the word the body is trying to heal with all its immune system and all reparative processes.
Yes, that's perfect. That is correct. Way to
phrase it. Let me add one more symptom that was, you guys touched on it, but kind of let me delve into it a little bit more.
Go ahead,
reaction,
Chris.
Reaction time. That goes on the cognitive side.
Right.
Reaction time is something that's very important to have recovered for a number of different reasons. If you're driving a car and you have a slowed reaction time because of your concussion, you're putting yourself and other people at risk. If you're an athlete and you're playing with a concussion, you have a slowed reaction time, you're not only putting your head at risk, you're also putting other body parts, your knee, your ACL, you know, your back, your hips. The reaction time is what I see a lot of times to be the last thing that returns. And that goes on the cognitive side of things, but in terms of day-to-day life and living, as well as sports participation, a slowed reaction time could have grave consequences, or just not grave consequences, but that, you know, can lead to more subsequent injuries because you're not fully recovered from that side. So reaction time is the one thing you guys touched on, almost, I think, all of them. But on that cognitive side, I just wanted to be clear on the reaction time is something that usually is the last thing that returns in the concussion recovery process.
Thank you.
Well,
I hope we're
one more.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say one more important point to kind of touch on that my brother was mentioning. They've done a ton of studies and more coming out in the last few years in terms of linking a history of previous concussion or multiple concussions and lower extremity injuries. There are a lot of papers coming out on that, and there's a definitive correlation there. we look at poor motor control. And if you think of, for example, the female population is more at risk of sustaining an ACL injury, the anterior cruciate ligament. That's one of the stabilizing ligaments in the knee.
Matt, yeah. Please explain what that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is one of the major stabilizing ligaments in the knee. So you wouldn't think, okay, how is my knee susceptible just because I had a concussion? My brain's up here, my knee's down there. The reality is it's all connected. So that poor reaction time, as my brother talked about, that poor motor control, you may have already baseline deficits because we study that in the absence of a concussion population. So we study that in the normal population, the normal athletic population. There are predisposing factors to injuring that. So when you throw a concussion on top of that, that increases the risk of those subsequent injuries by several fold.
You know what? Let me just make this point, too. We talk a lot about these other injuries that can happen, and it might seem to our listeners it might be a little doom and gloom, but the great thing is if you get with a good concussion team, we know how to correct and get your reaction time back, but it needs to be identified. You can correct these factors. You can get back to your normal self, but you need to identify. You need to know the recovery process. You need to know how to rehabilitate a concussion. And so we're giving you all these warning signs and scenarios that might sound a little gloomy, but the good news is we can treat them and they can be identified and we can get you back to better.
Thank you. And, you know, Chris, as well as Matt, you know, this is a big topic, as you know. And with regard to trying to cover all the bases, that's a little bit hard within an hour. We may want to come back on another Saturday, maybe talk about treatment protocols, rehabilitation protocols. How do we get our patients, our young athletes, our children, even our elderly, back to functioning? So I think that may be the topic of the next time we do sit down and have a roundtable. If I can continue, I had another, you know, as far as we all love our football. And, you know, with regard to return to participation, with regard to our professional athletes getting back into the play, and we mentioned about recovery being maybe 14 days, maybe 21 days. Chris, how do we return these athletes? How do we know when they're ready to go back? You know, how
Absolutely.
Do you do it? You know, you deal with professional athletes. Same with you, Matt. When do you get them back to, you know, back to work, please?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? When can I go back to my activity? When can I go back to my sport? When can I go back to work? So there's a graded return-to-play protocol, a return-to-work protocol, a return-to-life protocol that's been accepted and debated and agreed upon across the world, actually. These are consensus guidelines from Zurich. And so if you get a concussion, I always tell my athletes, if you're concussed, you know, in the NFL, if you're concussed in the MLS, if you're concussed in Pennsylvania high school sports, if you're concussed in midget or youth football, the boxing ring, no matter what venue you have a concussion, there is thankfully an established consensus return to sport guideline. And the first step of that is 24 hours, no symptoms, meaning no physical symptoms of the concussion, no headaches, not feeling slowed down, not feeling, you know, irritable, you know, your symptoms have subsided. That's the first step. The second step is, as I mentioned before, the energy mismatch that happens. The second step is, okay, we had 24 hours, no physical exertion, the symptoms are better. Okay, what do we do next? Well, let's add some physical exertion. So step two is actually a light aerobic exercise, like a walk or a light jog for 15 or 20 minutes. And you basically can have some heart rate targets, but essentially you're just looking at a light aerobic activity. That goes well. 24 hours later, you do a little bit more intense activity. Yes.
Hey, don't steal our thunder for the next show. Let's let them hang a little bit.
So,
all right,
don't give them all the answers.
Okay.
All right. We want to bait
their interest. And there's nuances. There is nuances through all of this. And because we are running a little short on time and we're saving some teasers for the next show, there is a graded return to play that you can get back to. And there's some nuances with it that we will discuss next time. But essentially, there's consensus guidelines across the world that no matter what sport or what activity you've injured yourself in terms of a concussion, There's a graded return to play that gets you back. And I liken it to when you have a heart problem, you get a stress test to evaluate, you know, is your heart abnormal? Well, there is a concussion stress test, thankfully, that we can stretch you and figure out if you're feeling better and good enough to go back to sports.
Beautiful. Matthew, did you want to comment also, sir?
No, I was just going to say in terms of the recent literature, there's Dr. Letty out of Buffalo that my brother was kind of touching on. They've looked at, you know, randomized controlled studies looking at the early aerobic exercise activity in the period of concussion versus, you know, for example, stretching protocols or less exertional protocols. And the interesting thing, at least the preliminary findings from the study, they are in favor improving the recovery timeline and also shortening that from the control group. So that's something that maybe we can expand on next time too.
Yeah, we call it sub-symptom threshold exercise. So big terminology,
right.
But basically exercise below the level of your symptoms, meaning if walking around the block creates your symptoms to get worse, that's too much. Maybe we're talking about walking down the driveway and walking back. But Matt is
Chris,
absolutely
let's
correct.
Let's see that for a teaser.
A protocol.
Let's see that teaser.
What's
out
that?
There. Let's see that
teaser
out there.
We got
we're
it.
Giving
yep.
all the teasers away. You know, I think Mark Mancini had a slew of questions, but Mark, go ahead. What do you have?
Yeah, Gail from Florida, a regular listener coming in, basically says, great show as always, Doc. And she says, you know, you talk about the stress factors and stuff like that. Meditation is the best antidote for me. Any thought to that?
I am hugely in favor. I'm hugely in favor of meditation. What you do is you actually increase the vagal overtone in your system. So there's a nerve called the vagus nerve that's the rest and digest, turns off the fight and flight response in your system. And so meditation actually lowers your body's need to produce more energy. And I'm a huge fan of meditation in all areas of life. But I would also advocate in this in recovery. I think it's an amazing tool that we underutilize.
Good. And Matthew, do you look at that also? You're coming from a different point of view, but do you feel that is an asset as well?
Oh, absolutely. I think that Gail brings up an interesting point too, a theme that something may work well for one individual that may not work well for another individual. I mean, my brother explained kind of the basic science underlying that, but some of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, but there's an individual kind of stress profile. So if you have this happen, you can kind of figure out what works best for you, which type of environment, because each body's going to respond a little bit different. Yes, there are underlying scientific themes that we'll see, but that point of, well, this works really well for me, okay, continue to do it because obviously that's working for you.
Got it.
Yeah, that gets to a good point. You have to individualize the treatment plan and recovery. Absolutely.
Absolutely. It all has to be customized. Even though maybe the injuries are similar, there's still customization because of a patient's health status. Let me see about Mark. You have one more for us down there?
Yeah, I got one more with about 10 minutes left in this great show. Tom from Modesto, California comes in. He said he sees a lot of ads on TV for shingles, doesn't know what you're supposed to do if there's something to prevent that, but it's over 50. He can't remember if he's ever had chicken pox when he was young. Any thought to that, guys, as we start to differentiate different topics here?
Well, you know what? Could we hold that question till our next show?
Yeah.
That's a little bit off topic today, and I have a few more things to talk about, but we'll be glad to answer the shingles question. You know, gentlemen, what I wanted to do today, just to finish this, I didn't want to get into treatment, but I did want to get into diagnostic inventories. You know, how do you diagnose a concussion? You know, do you use a formal format? Are there questionnaires that you use? You know, what system do you use to diagnose it? What systems are you evaluating? Again, you know you have a protocol for it. Can you help share the protocol looking at how you diagnose concussion? Do you think that's a fair question here ending up our program today?
Yeah, I can take that, Greg, because there's a lot of different ways to diagnose concussions. There's different sideline concussion assessment tools that are agreed upon, group of questions and physical tests to kind of look at if a patient had a concussion or not. There's some different balance testing, balance error scoring system called the BEST testing. There's the King-Devick test, which deals with cognitive and balance issues. So essentially what I do or what I would recommend in terms of protocol for diagnosing a concussion is you have to have the inciting event, and you have to sometimes dig for it. Sometimes it's not a helmet-to-helmet collision. Sometimes it's repetitive lineman, you know, helmet-to-helmet collisions from a close proximity that you add up those repeated injuries to the head, and it ends up in concussive-type symptoms. So you have an inciting event or trauma, and you couple that with the symptoms that we just talked about at a little bit of length that are related to concussion. And so you put those two things together, an injury and the symptoms related to concussion, and you put those two things together, and you can diagnose a concussion. Unfortunately, there is not a widely available MRI or CAT scan or ultrasound test or something of that type of nature that can say, okay, there's the brain. I see the concussion injury on the brain. There it is. There's development of different testing, you know, functional and MRI testing from a functional side of things. There's blood testing and blood markers in concussion. Those are all being investigated and researched. But essentially, to boil it down, it's inciting trauma event, and it's the concussive type symptoms, and you put those things together, and you can clinically, we call it clinically diagnose a concussion, meaning there's not a diagnostic test that we're widely available that we can use yet, but we can use our diagnostic prowess as physicians and our experience and our expertise to put those things together and say, yes, you do have a concussion. Is that fair answer, Greg?
Yeah, that's excellent. You know, Chris, what I've been telling my listeners for several months, you know, in a sense, how I do business. And I talked about the four pillars, and you really looked at them as well for me. You know, the first pillar being the history. You know, how did it happen? What's the past medical history? You know, is it one concussion or is it a series of concussions? Pillar number two, of course, is physical examination. You know, you can't see a concussion, but indeed, you know, you're looking for physical signs. Our pillar three is the diagnostic workup, and there's no easy test that'll answer all the questions. And then the fourth pillar that I talk about is decision making, where we're taking the history, the exam, the diagnostic tests, then you and your brother as professionals go ahead and you put it together to come up with, this is what we have, this is what we think our best would be, that indeed we've been detectives, now we're going to help to treat you. And that's kind of how I look at medicine, and I think you and your brother look at it the same way. Am I correct?
Yeah, you just hit on it. They call it, it's the art of medicine for a reason. There's nuance, there's interpretation, there's experience. You cannot discredit the amount of experience and the amount of patients that you see, and you log those patients in your brain and you bring them out later to help diagnose another patient. You are absolutely right, Greg. There's so much to the evaluation of any medical problem. Since we're talking about concussions, yeah, we can stay there, but there's so much to the evaluation and there's so many data points we can pull from, but it takes the clinician to bring it all together, formulate that in a nice package and deliver a diagnosis to a patient. And sometimes the diagnosis is, well, we're not quite sure yet. We got to do more testing. But sometimes we can't give that diagnosis right away.
Thank you for summarizing that. And, you know, we're kind of getting out of our time. Matt, would you like to kind of summarize things today in a brief, maybe a minute or two, please? And then we'll go back to you, Chris, and I'll close up.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground. The diagnosis and the definition of a concussion is a mild traumatic brain injury. We talked about the injury pattern that the brain experiences, that imbalance of neurotransmitters, the symptoms that the athlete or patient is going to feel in terms of correcting those balances and how it manifests as fatigue, fogginess, et cetera. And then probably one of the most important points is being evaluated by a licensed healthcare provider. There's no one particular symptom that clearly defines, yes, I have a concussion. So it's important to definitely get evaluated and be put into a graduated return to activity protocol. You know, as we were alluding to, the imaging a lot of times is imaging is going to be normal. So it's a diagnosis of exclusion. I think that probably the most important point is getting in with a team of multidisciplinary providers. That is what is going to lead to you getting back to your baseline activity as quickly as possible and in a healthy fashion.
Excellent, Matthew. Christopher, would you like to wrap up in a brief statement, please?
Absolutely. That's a good summary, Matt, of our conversation. And as Greg already talked about, we can talk more and more. We could probably do 10 shows or more on this topic because it is an emerging area of interest. But I would just echo that you want to be evaluated. If you're one of the 80%, the 4 out of 5 that recover without much of an issue over the first 2 weeks, that's great. And that's the majority of people. But if you are listening or know someone that is one of the 1 out of 4 that's, you know, months out from a head injury, years sometimes out from a head injury, do not suffer with what you have. You can reach out and find a multidisciplinary concussion team in your area to make the diagnosis, develop an individualized, customized treatment plan for you and get you on the road to recovery. So just know there's hope for that if you're listening and you're one of those 20% that has not fully recovered or know someone like that.
So, Matt, I thank you for the summary. Christopher, I thank you both very much for being on our show today. We had quite an excellent listenership as well. And, Mark, I just want to finish up. Do you have any more questions we could get on?
Yeah, a lot of them are basically saying that they're learning so much each and every week. Keep the flame burning and asking if we can get
thank
on
you
3 to 5 times a week. And I'm basically responding, and the doctor would have to do double duty.
Dr. Rocco, well, waiting for the interest.
Quit the day job.
Yeah, my everyday job. But thank you for the kind words. I do appreciate it. So
let everybody know. Doc, I mean, this was great. We got to get these guys back. The band of brothers was excellent, and let everybody know what's going on next week as well.
Sure. I'll let you know next week, then we'll give you the contact information for Dr. Matt Varicella and Dr. Christopher Varicella, if you would like to contact them. Next week, I have Dr. Libby Smith on, University of Pittsburgh Voice Center Specialist, talking about the aging voice. Why does our voice tend to get weaker as we get older? And she's superb. There's many conservative measures, but there's also surgical measures. So, Dr. Chris, how do we get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you could reach me via telephone or email. So I'll give you my email. It's cvaracallo@gmail.com. And then if you want a consultation, if you're in the area, the office number is 814-375-6200.
Excellent. Dr. Matthew.
Yeah, so are you going to be posting these anywhere, or is it just – because I'll try to spell it out a little bit easier. My email is M-A, V as in Victor, A-R-A, V as in cat, A-L-L-O, at phhealthcare.org. And the same phone number for me, 814-375-6200. I'll also put a plug in for my website, too, if you don't mind, Greg.
Go ahead, please.
MatthewVaricelloMD.com. And I also am pretty active on social media. My Instagram handle is DJVCITYMD. So that's kind of an interesting topic. I was a DJ as a background, so that's how that evolved. And then my Twitter handle is actually DJVCity, VCITY. So.
Wonderful. And, you know, my audience, if you'd like to contact me, GJRMD308Outlook.com. Mr. Mancini, what do you have, sir, to finish?
Well, I'll tell you, it is being hashtagged all over. If you want to know where it's going, all over the social media platforms, hashtag doctors, nurses, hospitals, football, NFL, health, and Pittsburgh. So we get this thing out. The listenership's very consistent each and every week, and we're just so blessed to do this each and every Saturday. And as we wrap this up, Doc, for you out there in Pittsburgh, for these band of brothers. If anybody misses this show, catch it on blogtalkradio.com/Mancini Sports Podcast platforms, wherever you subscribe to podcasts, powered down by Mancini Media. We'll be back next week, same time, same channel. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, and happy Martin Luther King Day on Monday.
Yep.
Beautiful.
Bye.
All right, see you.